Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends, and welcome to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com, or you can go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. Here on this program and on our blog, we talk about the future. We talk about emerging technologies and emerging possibilities. We talk about a tomorrow that's coming very soon that we think we will all want to live to see. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in our virtual cyber studio is my co-host, co-futurist, and co-blogger, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
You know, I'm super fantastic, but I have to say I'm a little wiped because we were just talking about before the program started. I've been packing all weekend in preparation for a big move that. The SpecuWife and I are going to be making next week. So I'm going to be out of town all week on business, so we had to get our packing done over the weekend, and it's quite exhausting.
There's nothing more exhausting than packing, especially in a house that you've been in for a number of years.
Things sort of settle into place.
Yeah, exactly.
You kind of spread out and get comfortable, and then it's time to pack it all up. And we have been here for almost 8 years, so almost 7 years. So that's a lot of time to spread out that required packing it back in, and that's what I've been doing today. So.
Well, the house that you're in now is a lovely house. I guess I should ask about the new house. Where are y'all just in the same area, or what's the plan?
Yeah, we are. We're staying right in the same vicinity. Not even changing zip codes. Still be in Highlands Ranch, Colorado. Just a little further down the road. We got a place actually a little bit up the hill, so that we kind of have a view now, which we never exactly had a view of Denver or the mountains or any of that kind of thing. And it's a slightly bigger place, so we have room for a guest room and an office. I won't have to be doing my podcasting in the guest room anymore. There'll be a kind of a division of a breakdown of place within the house. So,
you won't have to kick your guest out of their room in order to do this podcast. Yeah, that's great.
That's right. They can they can relax and stay where they are. Of course, they're welcome to stay now. They just need to be quiet.
Exactly. So tell your mom to be quiet. I know she's sitting over there in the corner while we do the show.
Exactly. Anyway, how about you? How are you doing?
Oh, it's been a good weekend. Been great. We've just kind of been taking it easy around here, but yeah. I wanted to get into a little bit about a couple of the posts that you had mentioned had gotten going earlier this week, Phil. And I guess this is the our Astounding Science Facts, isn't it?
Well, I tell you what. Before we leap into Astounding Science Facts, let's just give a heads up that we're going to talk a little bit of AGI this week, artificial and general intelligence, because we're planning next week we're going to have Ben Gertzel on the show from Novamente. And in fact, he and Bruce Klein and a bunch of luminaries from the artificial intelligence world are at the first ever AGI conference, which is going on this week. And we were hoping to get some audio from that. That didn't work out for us tonight. But we will talk a little bit about AGI tonight, and we're looking forward next week to getting into artificial general intelligence. Just wanted to kind of get that up there at the start that's kind of our theme. But having established that that's our theme, why don't we take a moment and listen to a few of what we like to call
Astounding Science Facts.
I'm still in awe of my own intro there. I feel like I could never give anything quite astounding enough to live up to that intro. But we're gonna take a shot. I did a post called Miracle and Wonder. For those who read the blog, you're already familiar with this. But for those who aren't, I'll just run you through the concept. I came upon this headline. It was an actual news headline, and it was so out of context. It was so bizarre, seemingly incredible, that I said, you know, that looks like something right out of the Weekly World News. Stephen, you remember the Weekly World News, or is that before your time?
No, I remember it quite well. It was still active in the 90s, I believe.
I think so, yeah.
It was one of the wilder of the tabloids, wasn't it? It would not have been out of place in the Men in Black movie where he said, you know, here's the hot sheets, you know.
Yeah, that would be like
that was Weekly World News,
official newspaper for the universe of Men in Black, because the stories in there were just absolutely outrageous, just bizarre. You know, Bigfoot stole my wife. There was one
alien in the Kennedy White House. You know, I remember that one well.
Ruined temples found on Mars.
Yeah.
And what was the guy? Oh, the Jimmy Hoffa, right? There was this thing about, you know, whatever happened to Jimmy Hoffa, and it said Jimmy Hoffa's body found in Elvis's grave.
Which you know, begs the question now, where's Elvis? Well, he's still alive and well.
Yeah, of course, Elvis would have been, you know, out doing his thing, because he never died, absolutely. And
yeah,
they had running stories on what Elvis was doing. In fact, if you wanted to keep up with what Elvis was doing, that's probably a primary.
Didn't they also have Bat Boy? Was that the paper with Bat Boy?
They did have Bat Boy. He has a series of stories on Bat Boy.
Yeah.
He was an unfortunate-looking kid.
Too bad.
I believe those photos were highly retouched. I'd like to think they were. And,
oh, come on. You're so cynical, Phil.
No, I mean, you know, to make him look better.
Oh, okay. He looked more like a bat than those big ones.
Yeah, you want to clean up Bat Boy just a little bit. But anyway, so I came upon this headline, and I thought, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take this headline, and I'm going to throw it in the middle of a bunch of Weekly World News headlines and see if the actual news headline sticks out, or if people would be able to tell the bizarre made-up news. I'm going to go ahead and call Weekly World News made-up news, since this is Astounding Science Facts and not Tales of the Paranormal, from the actual news story. So the headlines I listed were Seeing Eye Squirrels for Blind Dogs, one of my all-time favorites, by the way, unless that's the real one. Blind Man Regains Sight After Doctors Implant Son's Tooth in His Eye. Groom Freezes at Nudist Wedding. Severed Leg Hops 75 Feet. Scientist Invents Reverse Light Bulb That Makes Room Darker. And doctors reattach Siamese twins. So out of those, Stephen, now you wrote that you had a three-way tie going. Is that right?
Three-way tie. I discounted the seeing eye squirrel for blind dogs. I'm sorry. I just didn't see how that would work. And so I just kind of tossed that one. And then groom freezes at nudist wedding. Well, you know, I figure if it's a nudist wedding, you know, that they'd make sure it was in a warm climate. You know, it sounds like the sort of thing that might happen in Phoenix, you know. So it's not likely to, freeze to death. Severed leg hops 75 feet. Well, maybe if it's a chicken leg, but
that's a long way to go, though.
Yeah, exactly. And so the ones I was left with, I said there's some possibility, you know, that this could happen in this universe. Blind man regains sight after doctors implant son's tooth in his eye. I was thinking, well, maybe somehow stem cells are involved. So maybe. And then scientists invent reverse light bulb that makes room darker. Now, you know, could that be? The truth is, I don't know enough about light to I'm not a physicist. I can't say whether or not that could happen. So, you know, okay, let's keep that as a possibility. Doctors reattach Siamese twins. Well, you know, if they had taken them apart and for some reason they're, you know, one was about to die or something, they thought, well, if we can put them back together briefly, maybe we can, you know, work something out where we can save them both or something. I could, you know, perhaps. So I said I got a three-way tie. All of these sound bizarre, but those three are the ones that sound like they could be true. Yeah.
Well, actually, I think really the most plausible one has got to be groom freezes at nudist wedding.
Yeah, well.
Because that's like, okay, a guy was naked and he froze to death. I mean,
did we start wearing clothes as a species to keep freezing in the last ice age? So, yeah. Okay.
However, had that been it, it certainly wouldn't have been an astounding science fact. Doctors reattaching Siamese twins would be. It would be a horrible, sad thing. And, you know, I would think that probably both of the both of the twins' lives would have to be in danger, because you would think that probably the risk of reattaching them would be that you might kill them both. So if, like, somehow they were both about to die, they might try to, but that's just, anyway, that wasn't it. Reverse light bulb, I can see why you would want to go for that one, just because that's such an intriguing idea.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
You know, some kind of like light, magnet or something. Yeah.
Yeah, it's sort of pulling the light out of the room. It's a pretty cool idea. I went with those three. It turns out it is one of those three.
You did get one of the three, and of course the one that turns out to be correct is the one we haven't mentioned, but that's the blind man regaining his sight after doctors implant the son's tooth in his eye. And it turns out that this is a fairly new but becoming well-respected practice called osteo-odonto-keratoprosthesis. And basically, let me read just a little bit from the news story that I linked there. McNichols, this was the man who was blind. His son Robert, 23, donated a tooth, its root, and part of his jaw for his father's surgery. McNichol's right eye socket was rebuilt and a lens was inserted into a hole drilled in Robert's tooth. The procedure required two surgeries lasting a total of 15 hours. So a correspondence that you wouldn't expect, but apparently that is actually there, is that there's some physiological similarities between the structure of a tooth and the structure of an eye, and in fact to the point that you can take a tooth, drill a hole in it, and rebuild part of the missing structure of an eye such that you can restore eyesight to someone who has lost their eyesight. And in fact, that is what happened.
If you're a parent and you're doing the tooth fairy thing, put those teeth away. Don't throw them out.
Hang on to those teeth.
Yeah,
those
who
teeth
knows?
Have some potential usefulness. Yeah. Although it looks like you can't use a dead tooth because they needed the root and also part of the guy's jaw. In order to actually make this work, but still, just a fairly amazing thing. So unexpected that a tooth could lead to fixing an eye. But that's I guess that's what makes it an astounding science fact. And that leads us to our second astounding science fact, which was the discovery that the galaxy that we live in is actually twice the thickness that we thought it was. And this was a group of scientists in, I believe it was Sydney, Australia. And they started crunching some existing numbers. They didn't actually have to go out and do new observations of the galaxy. They didn't have to go out and collect new measurements. What they did was they took a bunch of data that had already been collected.
Well, was the Hubble involved and other like telescopes, or was already
absolutely all sorts of different instruments? But the bottom line is they took a wide variety of measurements that had been taken as to what the thickness of the Milky Way galaxy is, and we're all agreed it's about 100,000 light years across, but the thinking was it was about 6,000 light years thick, and now this team is coming back and saying no, in fact it's about 12,000 light years thick. And the way they figured that out, I think it's very interesting that they did that just by crunching numbers in a spreadsheet, by taking existing data and honing it a little more closely than had been done up to this point. But what they found was that you're going to get a more accurate reading. A more accurate estimate of the thickness of the galaxy if you look at data points that are measured from the middle. If you look for things that are sitting out on the outer plane, high above or high below, those are going to give you a much more realistic estimate as to what the thickness is. And from that, they were able to say, in fact, the entire galaxy is probably about twice as thick as we originally thought it was.
That's pretty cool. Yeah,
that is very cool, and I'll tell you what, we'll go ahead and say, okay, well, that's our two. We're not going to do three this time. We've just got those two, so that does it for this edition of
Astounding Science Facts.
You know, but that story reminded me of something I'd heard before, Phil. It was kind of a breakdown of information, a description of information. It was called DIKW. Had you ever
IKW? So what is that?
Data is the simplest form of stuff. I mean, and information is the next step up from that. Knowledge is the next step up from that. That's the K in DIKW, and the W is wisdom. And so what these guys did is they took, you know, naked data and created some knowledge from it, or at least some information. The galaxy is twice as thick as we originally thought, and it's a pretty cool, you know, drawing information like that out of the data. I thought that was pretty nifty.
I thought that was really cool too. Let me just say that you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're taking your calls this entire program tonight. So if you have a question for us or a comment on any of the topics we're talking about, you can call us at 347-215-8972. And in fact, that was one of the things that that I said in the blog post about that story was, it makes you wonder how many more discoveries there are waiting to be made, not from going out and doing new research, but just from taking a closer look at data that is already there.
That's right. That's right. And you know, it is probably there's you know, who knows how much data we have available to us. Data is relatively, it's cheap. It's a commodity now, and so it's everywhere. Drawing the information out of it could be a whole new branch of science. And you could and learn fascinating things that, you know, you would think that if somebody had told me that, you know, we're going to find out that the galaxy is twice as thick as we originally thought, and what would be involved in discovering that, I would have guessed, you know, well, you know, you need to launch a couple of space telescopes at least, and you know, billions of dollars worth of a big science. Well, it turns out that you know, we just had to look at what we already had.
Yeah, you would think that at least that it would require a whole host of new observations, that a bunch of new measurements would have to be made, rather than that the answer was actually already sitting there in data that is already collected. Now, it should point out that the team is just getting to the point where they're publishing their results, and that might be disputed, and then there may be some discussion, but so far their methodology appears to be sound, and the initial reception that they're getting is a pretty positive one. So it makes you think, well, hey, maybe there's more to be discovered. Hey, you know, speaking of this breakdown from data to information to knowledge to wisdom, you know, it occurs to me that when we do one of these podcasts, there's a little bit of that going on, right? Because when we're talking and we're playing audio clips, that's actually just data in the computer, which is then you know, being transferred out over into other people's over the internet into other people's computers. They're listening to it, and that's becoming information, which hopefully then becomes knowledge for them, and hopefully they can benefit from not so much mine, but really your wisdom, I guess.
You know, the example I was going to use is, you know, the words, the sun is hot, the separate words, that's data.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
And, but you put those words together, and then you have some information, the sun is hot. Okay. And, you know, that in knowledge, that's, you know, that's, you know, when you step outside and you feel it, and the wisdom is to put on sunscreen.
I see. Okay.
You know, to act on the information and the knowledge and to do something to prevent getting hurt by the hot sun or something. So that's my basic understanding of it. So
it could be a while before our need for wisdom as regards the thickness of the galaxy kicks in. Because
I guess until we're actually traveling,
we're not doing an awful lot.
Yeah, we're not getting
level right now.
We're pretty provincial. We stay pretty close, don't we, right now?
Yeah, exactly.
To the earth.
Exactly. But the reason I brought up the analogy to the podcast is because I wanted to mention that for those who are listening who have expressed curiosity and concern, we still don't know what happened to the program 2 weeks ago. And that remains not even data at this point. It's more like a memory.
It's missing data. That's what it is.
It's a missing data. We have had one contact with Blog Talk Radio, and they told us we'd hear something back from them. Is that right? I mean, how was that left, actually?
We will get back to you and let you know. And that was 2 weeks ago. So
2 weeks ago, they said they would get back to us and let us know. And
I'm going to take the initiative and try to get back in touch with them now. So
yeah. Let's ping them again. But meanwhile, if anyone from Blog Talk Radio is listening, hey, we're waiting. We'd like to know what happened to our program from 2 weeks ago. We need to know if we need to have the guest back on to talk about the same things again, or if we can move on and have him on again to talk about new things. And it's just be good to know what happened, really.
If it was something I did, I'd like to know what it was so I don't ever do it again. So, you know.
Yeah, well, hey, if it was something you did, I'd like to know.
Yeah. You know, my position in this show might be in question. So,
yeah. Right.
Right.
Be starting out with me, as always, is PJ Manny.
Exactly. Yeah.
That could be the new line, all right? But seriously, if we did something wrong, we want to know what we did wrong. And if not, we just want to understand what happened. And, of course, if there's some way we can get that program up on line, if the recording still exists, we want to be able to share that with our readers, because there was quite a bit of interest in that program, not only for our usual listeners, but also for folks who are associated with Lifeboat Foundation, who were curious to see what Philip Van Nederveld had to say. So we're hoping to hear something back on that, and maybe this week they'll come back with something, or Stephen, keep pinging them, and we'll see what develops.
No doubt.
So why don't we shift gears just a little bit, and let's talk about I don't know if we're equipped to have a full AGI discussion, and we didn't get our audio clips that we were looking for to have that conversation, but we did a couple of subjects this week that I think tie into a discussion of artificial general intelligence. And the first of those that I want to talk about is the one about the cars of the future. Now, Stephen, you had linked to an article about cars of the future, and I think the question that's on everybody's mind about cars of the future is, when will we get to the point where the cars are driving themselves? And, I guess a related question for this discussion would be, would that be artificial general intelligence, or would that just be a highly specialized silo of artificial intelligence but not general intelligence, in your view?
Well, it's funny because we have moving goalposts for artificial general intelligence, it seems like. Until a computer beat the world's greatest human player in chess, playing a great game of chess was considered, monumentally, someone that's very intelligent does that. And then after that happened, all of a sudden the game of chess took, the prestige of the game kind of took a little hit. And now it's just, it's considered kind of a mechanistic thing almost.
Well, the prestige of the game takes a hit because, it's something that a machine can do.
A mere machine can do it. Well, then
why
are we so impressed anymore?
Right. Rather than crediting the machine with saying, now some piece of intelligence, and I wouldn't call playing chess general intelligence.
No, but it's a highly specialized.
But some piece of human intelligence now belongs to the machine world. Rather than saying, machines are this much smarter, what do? We say, chess is that much less impressive. Right?
Yeah.
That's the direction that...
That tells a lot about us as a species, I think. But and so I think that, right now, since we don't have cars that drive themselves, at least outside of DARPA contests, it would be a very impressive thing for that to happen, and it would begin to look almost like general intelligence, because it's not just following the rules of the road, when you drive, right, Phil? I mean, the basic rules of the road, stop for a green light, stop for a red light, go at the green light, come to stop, full stop at the stop sign, make sure nobody's coming, pull out. But there's a lot of other things that you have to keep in mind when you're driving. You got to think about the psychology of the other drivers around you. Sometimes if somebody's coming up fast to a stop sign in front of you, you might get off your gas and wait and see if they're really going to stop at the stop sign. That's something, that you kind of gain after having driven a while. And it seems almost like it would have to be almost a general intelligence to foresee some of the ways that people could act around you. Other drivers, human drivers, could act and to anticipate what they're thinking and what they're doing, and maybe even spot, oh, that guy looks like he might have had a few too many to drink, and since it is Friday night, maybe I should be careful of this guy. You know, things like that that we know as drivers, that's something that in order for a machine to be as good as us behind the wheel, it's going to have to be able to do. So it's pretty impressive processing capability if and when it happens.
If and when it happens, and I would say it's when it
yeah.
happens.
I think so too. I think it's going to happen. DARPA certainly thinks it's going to happen, because I think they're really pushing to have whole convoys with maybe one human driver, in one vehicle, and the others just going along for the ride. And you can imagine why they would want to do that. When in a place like Iraq where you've got roadside bombs. You know, if you've only got one human driver, then you're cutting the potential of casualties down if you're moving
right.
a whole convoy through, you know. So,
absolutely. Yeah, so certainly major assistance in driving, major and increasingly intelligent assistance in driving before we reach the point where the robots take over and do the driving. In fact, in the chat room, Michael Darling has pointed out that the Lexus F has radar guided cruise control. So you've got essentially this something similar to what pilots have with autopilot now available in a car. So you're heading in that direction, but I think the point's well made that that's still a long way from the ability to react to almost an infinite, it would seem almost infinite number of possible situations that can occur while driving. Actually, it's not an infinite number. It's a finite number. But when you compare that, what I'm going to call configuration space, that set of possibilities to, say, chess, you know, it's a huge difference in terms of the number of variables and factors that are involved. So to scale from being able to win at chess to being able to win at driving, whatever winning is, even the goal.
Winning is not getting in an accident, I bet.
Yeah, it's
getting there safe.
Safely, yeah, and getting there safe. Yeah, you know, and fuel efficiently. I mean, there's a lot of things you can throw into the mix, but ultimately, getting there safe is I guess winning for driving, and to be able to consistently win that game, you're going to be looking at a much higher bar for intelligence.
I have actually a perspective on this. I'm a personal injury attorney, but that's what I do. My thought on this is that it won't become a reality. And I'm talking about full, you know, click on the autopilot and go to the back and mix a drink kind of thing. That's not going to be a reality until these machines are significantly better at keeping you out of an accident than you are yourself. And I think the reason for that is just the liability exposure. You know, if a system was not better, then I don't think that they could offer it at least not in the United States in our climate. It cannot be offered as a full system, you know, for an autopilot system. It could not be offered until and unless it's actually better than, you know, a human driver. And what I mean by that is that, you know, once an accident happens, my job as a plaintiff's lawyer is to try to find who's to blame. Okay.
Right.
And if Ford said, you know, is able to show that, well, yeah, this autopilot, you know, it was unable to avoid this particular accident, but it's because it was completely unavoidable for a human, and it had a human been at the wheel, that would have been unavoidable for them as well. And so they'd have to be able to show that for them to be able to even offer it. And so
in the chat room, Michael says that avoiding injury or damage can't be the algorithm because you'd never leave the driveway. But in fact, that is the algorithm for us now. We always want to try to avoid injury. We want to try to avoid having an accident, and we do leave the driveway.
Right. Well, we have a, I mean, you know, we accept a certain level of risk.
Right.
When we get out on the road. But we're not going, you know, we as a country, this is my belief as a plaintiff lawyer and in this profession, I don't believe that we as a country will accept an autopilot that is not better, not equal to or better than the best human drivers. It just, we're not going to accept an increased risk like that. Now, what we may accept is something less, you know, like something that'll start tapping your brakes if you get too close to the vehicle in front of you, things like that. But I don't think that we would accept a full autopilot without data to show that it is actually equal to or better than the best drivers.
Well, and I think how we would establish that an autopilot was as good as or better than the best human driver, that would be a tricky thing to
establish. Yeah, and it could be, you know, that some driving is, you know, I could see a machine being taught to be equal to or better than the best driver on the interstate a lot easier than the stop-and-go traffic of in-town. On the interstate, sometimes the biggest challenge for a human driver is to stay awake, you know, not to allow the straight, you know, interstate to lull you to sleep. Well, a machine would not have a problem with that. And so perhaps it could, you know, the data could show that it, you know, on an interstate, it can follow the rules of the road and can be a better driver than a human. But when you get in the stop and go traffic, when human experience and human reflexes might be superior, then it might be illegal to engage it in that kind of traffic.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So it would be a pretty complicated algorithm to figure out, and what it would require is surfacing the fact that we already allow for the fact that a certain number of injuries and deaths will occur,
right,
based on the infrastructure that we have.
That's right. We accept as a society a certain number of highway deaths every year, and we just, but you know, we won't go further than that, I don't think.
Right. Michael's point, if we were trying to drive that number to zero, it would never happen.
That's right. And we're never going to see that number at zero. You know, even if we start being driven around by robots, I think that there you will still see some fatalities on the highway.
Yeah, well, especially if the robots get mad or go nuts or something like
that's
that.
Right, no doubt.
This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Phil Bauermaster and Stephen Gordon, we're talking about artificial general intelligence. If you have a question for us or a comment on any of the topics we're talking about this evening, you can reach us at 347-215-8972. Now, speaking of robots going nuts and becoming unreliable with the power that we've placed in their hands, another story that you linked this week and wrote a little bit about was battle robots that are used in a military setting. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it should be noted that so far we've not had any robots go nuts.
So far.
There was an accident, I understand, with a robot. It was not a U.S.-made robot. It was, I don't know, maybe it was Australian or something. At any rate, where it started firing, and I guess I should find that story and put it in the show notes. I don't have it in front of me now. There was an accident with one, but this, I don't think it could be argued that that it went nuts. What brought this up was a professor, a CHFO professor, Noel Sharkey, recently, you know, stated he's got some concerns about the armed military robots that are being deployed more and more. He says that as AI grows in power, as it becomes able to do more and more things, that we're going to be tempted to take humans out of the loop. Well, of course, right now the robots that we have that are deployed in Iraq are just basically remote control toys in a way. You know, I mean, you control them completely. They don't have any. There's no AI involved in it. It's just some person controlling it, and if necessary, taking a shot with them. And my understanding is these robots have not yet shot anyone in Iraq. which is interesting, I think. But it's they're certainly armed and ready to shoot somebody, I guess.
So we've got armed robots out there that could be shooting at people, but so far haven't.
So far haven't. So
that's very interesting. I wonder what the politics around that decision is. When do the robots?
When can you pull? Yeah, when can you pull the trigger remotely? I guess you need to be sure, because it's going to be a news story, I suppose, when the first robot takes a life in Iraq. And now, of course, we have had these aerial drones, unmanned aerial drones, so that have taken lives already. Specifically in Yemen, once here a few years ago, they took out a carload of terrorists. So it's already happened. It just hadn't happened with these ground-based units yet. They're called SWORDS, S-W-R-D-S, is the unit that's used the most in Iraq at this point. But
right,
I mean,
now, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say that I'm not as down on these robots as Noel Sharkey is. I think that there's definitely a place for them. One of his concerns is that terrorists could capture one of these units and reverse engineer it, and all of a sudden, we've got the other side. The terrorists have got these robots. I just doubt that very seriously. I don't think that would happen at all.
It seems like that is a risk that we face with any weapon.
Yeah.
That it might fall into the wrong hands. There's a couple of possibilities here. One, if you're talking about something that has to be remotely controlled, it's possible that if one were stolen, there could be fail-safes built in such that it would just fry its own circuit board and become useless.
Right.
Or that it's just simply impossible without the appropriate security clearances and codes and so forth that you would even be able to get in and make it do anything.
Yeah, and if you wanted to pull off parts or figure out how it works or whatever, my point in my post was there's a lot easier ways, if you're a terrorist, to make a remote control killing machine than to try to reverse engineer a SWORDS robot. And I pointed to a remote control toy car. I really shouldn't call it a toy, because the people who compete with these things are usually grown ups, and they're it's not much of a toy when it's it's powered by nitrous and it goes 45 miles an hour. But yeah, I'm talking like a 1/8 size model car that's remote controlled. You get something like that, and some of them are four wheel drive vehicles, and you strap a bomb to it, then you could have a very serious weapon relatively cheaply. And so I guess my point is.
Yeah, so why go to all the trouble of trying to reprogram a
SWORDS robot? Yeah, if you're a terrorist, then you're already using. Other devices to, for your own means, like things like cell phones. You're attaching them to C4, and you're calling in a bomb attack that way. That's the way those guys operate. They take our toys and our gadgets, and they duct tape them together to make something make something bad out of. That's the way they operate. They're not going to reverse engineer a SWORDS robot any more than they would reverse engineer a fighter plane. It's beyond their capabilities, beyond it just wouldn't be worth it from the money point of view for them.
Yeah.
For them.
Yeah, they do things on the cheap.
Yep.
Interesting comment from our friend Matt Doing in the chat room. He says, I think that within 30 years, computers will be as much better drivers as they currently are superior checker players to us now. And let's take that one step and say, well, 30 years from now, will they be that much more efficient in the field as weapons, or will that take another 40 or 50 years? But it raises the question that I believe you answered in the negative, which is, will we at some point see completely autonomous armed robots out in the field?
I didn't answer it in the negative exactly, Phil. What I was saying there was that we need to be very, very careful about that. But I appreciated your response to that. Which was?
Yeah, and my response was, well, we might have to if other people are, right? If the enemy is building robots that are autonomous, if the enemy is building robots that are going out and using responses and reflexes that are a million times faster than any human, the only way we'd be able to fight those weapons would be with our own that we're doing the same. You would almost have to take humans out of the loop just to remain competitive, at which point you've got a really scary arms race going on.
Right. And let's hope that our robots stay on our side and don't join up with the robots for the other side and decide that we're the real enemy. Yeah. That's, basically the plot of Terminator, So.
Well, it's interesting if you combine two very, very different threats. And one was we talked about, I don't know if it was last week or maybe a couple of weeks ago, but we talked about these algorithms that are being developed for hedge fund trading. The kinds of algorithms that currently have quants developing that very smart humans who know a lot of math, but that we will see in the near future, computer programs themselves will be developing the next generation of algorithms. And then we've got this this arms race in its own right between the different financial institutions of getting just the slightly faster, slightly better, slightly broader view of what's happening in the market in order to get an edge in terms of, what you're buying, what you're selling, when you're doing it, the volumes, et cetera. Now, if you see that kind of arms race eventually going critical, which is possible, it's possible that eventually these kind of recursive self-improving artificial intelligences that are trying to solve financial problems hit this point of something approaching artificial general intelligence. And at the same time, you've got this arms race going on where robots are becoming increasingly faster and increasingly smarter at finding other robots and killing them. I don't know. You marry those two things, and it does start to sound a little bit like the Terminator, doesn't it?
Just a little bit. My thought on that is that you have to have two major, superpowers basically at war with each other in a conventional sense for you to actually see that come about, that sort of arms race. Because, again, the terrorists are not going to participate in that arms race. They might.
Right. You would need conventional players, I think,
right,
making that happen. On the other hand, you definitely
and we really haven't seen a war like that since World War II. We've had some proxy wars between the U.S. and the Soviet Union in those years. I mean, Vietnam and North Korea to some extent.
Well, I would disagree with that. I think that the biggest arms race we've seen in our lives occurred during the Cold War, not during World War II. And in fact, a similar situation, high tension situation, could potentially develop between, say, the U.S. and China,
yep.
Which might lead to. In fact, we've seen just in the last couple of weeks where China shot down one of their satellites, and then lo and behold, hey, we had to shoot down one of our satellites. And that kind of brought me back to the good old days of the Cold War when Russia would do something and we would do it, or we would do something and then Russia would do it. There's a little bit of an echo of that there. I'm not suggesting that we didn't need to shoot that satellite down, but it was an interesting timing that it occurred shortly after China had done the same thing.
Would it make it more acceptable to go to war if all that's fighting is machines? China basically sends machines into, Alaska or someplace, and we meet their machines with our own machines. I mean, it's our fingers off the nuclear button, for example, if no one's dying. We're just letting our technology battle it out. I don't know. It's an interesting question also, I would think.
Well, the big arguments that get raised against wars, blood and treasure, you've taken the blood out of the equation.
You just got treasure.
And now it's just treasure. So I would think that to a large extent it would be more acceptable. I think the fear would be that firepower would be turned on civilian populations. Or,
right.
Or that somehow that they would be hitting the actual human personnel who are somewhere still in the loop.
Right.
It's hard to imagine that they're completely removed from the loop. Michael Darling comments that the casualty protections have stopped a lot of violence and war. And one of the things that's been observed is that wars seem to be getting less destructive in terms of human life. ever since World War II, the trend has been for wars to last longer but to kill a lot fewer people, which is an interesting kind of end game for that trend might be to have robots fighting each other, and the wars would go on for centuries, but no human beings would die. Strange thought.
Yeah, it is. I'm not sure I would like that war either, though. You know?
I don't know. If there were a gun to Mecca, I got to say it would be wicked cool to actually see it going on. I mean, if wars were
five-story tall giant robots battling it out with each other.
Yeah, exactly.
What you do is you film that, and you could broadcast it as entertainment both in China and in the U.S. And yeah,
that's right. And whoever gets the best ratings, you fight your wars like it's American Idol, and we could decide the wars by who gets voted off or something like that.
That's right.
The whole thing can become like a big reality show. I don't know. That seems like a
lot. Yeah, and whoever's robot wins, we have it accepted in advance who's what that means. You know, if China's robot wins, then they get some territory or something. I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah.
We just have that negotiated in advance. So that's anyway. Strange, though.
Yeah, it's a thought. Well, listen, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We'll be on for another 15 minutes or so. So if you have a burning question, you want to comment about Gundam Mecha or hedge fund arms race, you can reach us at 347-215-8972. Another comment that Michael had made in the chat room was that he pointed out a few of the major players on the financial markets side. And what's interesting, just to swing that back around, you pointed out, well, unless you have conventional players and a couple of big powers, you're probably not going to get this robot arms race. But there's no question that in the financial services side, that definitely there are the big players, and they definitely are going for blood, figuratively speaking.
Right.
And
that's
that
happening. It's happening already, isn't it?
Yeah, that thing is actually going on. I mean, that's happening. If I were a betting man, and I don't count my poker playing as gambling. You understand that's a game of skill. But if I were a betting man, I would suggest that the likeliest commercial place that artificial general intelligence might come from would be from exactly there, from the financial markets. People talk about
trying to get just a little bit of an edge.
Exactly.
On where the market's going next. Yeah.
Yeah. Because there is money driving that.
Right.
And there's a lot of money driving that. And there's a lot of money driving people trying to find a way to get just a little more improvement and a little more improvement and a little more improvement. And it seems to me that could lead to something huge. And not necessarily something all that welcome. I'm not sure that a killer hedge fund
cutthroat hedge fund like that might not be the best place to find a friendly AI.
Exactly. I'm not sure how friendly an artificial general intelligence would be that sprang from those origins. I would worry about our future at that point if that in fact is where it came from.
Yeah.
Going back to our astounding science facts just for a moment, there was an interesting comment from Matt. He linked us to a story. I don't know if you saw this in the chat room about human regeneration of a finger.
Okay.
And I was just thinking, well, if I had heard that, if Matt had gotten that one to me a little sooner, we could have had three rather than two topics on the astounding science fact. Basically, it says regrowing fingers, tissue regeneration technology already exists, and they actually have a picture here of what looks to me like a finger that's been just about, I don't know, completely cut off above the top joint.
Mm-hmm.
And they show a before and after photo, and the after photo is there's the finger, it's back again. So
that's cool. Let me get you. Maybe we need to put this one out there as a bet. A gamble or whatever. Which comes first? And these are basically mutually exclusive technologies, if you ask me. Which comes first? The Luke Skywalker arm or hand, or the ability to just regrow whatever it is that we lose?
Wow.
Which comes first? And if we have the capability of regrowing whatever we lose, I think that we would prefer that to the fully realistic hand that Luke Skywalker got in that second movie.
Well, I never got the impression that Luke could feel with that hand the way he could have felt with his original arm, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, to the extent that it was kind of, you know, clicky when it, you know, when he used it, it sounded
it was fully functional. You got the impression that it was every bit as useful as the other hand.
Right.
But maybe it didn't, you know, he didn't feel quite the same way with it, and it made an actual loss to him. I got that impression too. But I mean, you look at it and it looks perfectly real. So, and that is something that DARPA is pushing towards. They actually are calling it the Luke Skywalker Project.
I'm disappointed that they're not calling it the Steve Austin Project, I have to say. For those old enough to have any idea who that is, thanks for listening. And for those everyone else, Steve Austin was the $6 million man.
Roger. BCSI switches on. Okay, Victor. Landing rocket arm switches on. Here comes the throttle. Circuit breakers in. We have separation.
Roger.
Inboard and outboard are on. We're coming forward with the side stick.
Oh, looks good.
Roger. I've got a blowout. Number 3.
Get your pitch to 0.
Pitch is out. I can't hold altitude. Correction. Alpha mode is off. Trip select is emergency. Flight calm. I can't hold it. She's breaking up. She's breaking.
Steve Austin, astronaut. A man barely alive. Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man. Steve Austin will be that man. Better than he was before. Better, stronger, faster.
Oh, it cut off. We didn't get the big payoff with the rest of the scene.
Dum 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 dum. Okay.
I'm so impressed that you just had that ready to be played when I mentioned Steve Austin. That makes me want to say other obscure things.
And just see what I have available over here. Huh?
Yeah, that you're gonna click on. That sums it up. That was the TV show. I guess it ran probably 72 to the late 70s, something like that. Anyway,
was it that early? I guess so.
Well,
maybe
72, 73. It was pretty early, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. Anyway, that was where a lot of us got our first look at that sort of thing. But apparently, the Luke Skywalker arm is the one that's really caught people's imagination. So,
I think that tells us the age of the guys that are working on the project.
Yeah, well, it does. That they're younger than me. For sure. Anyway, Matt says that their team's trying for the Luke Skywalker prosthetics by 2010.
That's right. Exactly.
I would imagine that we won't have entire regenerated arms in the next, what,
three
less
years,
than 2 years?
2 years,
so,
2.5, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to have to say that I would bet, along with it looks like everybody in our chat room, that we'll have the Luke Skywalker bionics. I'm going to call them the Austin Bionics first. Yep.
Well, I guess it's a matter of degree, you know, to what, how realistic, how well does it work? Is it better, stronger, faster, you know, or is it just, you know, does it look like a mannequin hand and has a good deal more function than a regular prosthetic hand, but it's not, you know, exactly how close is it to Luke Skywalker's hand?
Exactly. Yeah. What can you do with it besides, I mean, can you feel with it? I think that's an important question. Oh, our research department has come back that the regular series $6 million man ran from 1974 to 1978.
I thought it was a little bit later than that.
Well, that's the
regular series. I was old enough to appreciate it, and you see, I was born in 69.
Well, that's the regular series, but before that it was part of something called the ABC Action Movie or ABC Action Pack or something like that, and there were $6 Million Man as a regular show before that 74 series, so I'm gonna stick with
that. Now, the original TV movie was like a TV movie based on a certain novel. Can you name that novel?
The novel was called Cyborg, and the author escapes me for the moment. But
I bet you there's somebody in a chat room who knows who the author was. But
yeah, well, I know our research department. Say our research department.
Yeah, that's right.
if you say that. It's on the tip of my tongue, Cyborg by, this is like that time we couldn't think of William Gibson. This is less embarrassing than that, though.
Yeah.
So that takes us to our final topic of the evening, which is we did a little further look at Orion this week. I managed to find a really cool video of a TED Talk with George Dyson talking about Project Orion, which you had mentioned. Was it on last week's show? Or,
It's a perennial topic. We bring it up, seems like, about every fourth or fifth show. We bring up Project Orion because it's just so cool that, you know, 30 years ago they were thinking about the motto of the project was Saturn by 70. And not 2070, but 1970.
1970. That's
they
right.
thought that they could get to Saturn in a space, in a big spaceship, not like a little tin can like we sent to the moon. We're talking like a battleship with, you know, probably 50 or more people in it. And
a huge nuclear bomb powered rocket to Saturn. It's just it is such a retro sounding project, and you can imagine George Dyson as a kid, who's, you know, hearing from his dad, you know, what are you working on? Well, we're getting ready to build a spaceship to Saturn.
Yeah.
I mean, I can almost imagine having your dad say something cooler than that, but I can't quite imagine having your dad say something.
That and for him to be serious.
Yeah, any dad has ever seriously said to their kid that that he was working on. So even though this was a top-secret Air Force project, was not a NASA project, NASA finally got their hands on it, is what we learned from watching the video. NASA finally got their hands on it and shut it down. But this top-secret Air Force project, George Dyson grows up and he's like, I got to find out what this was all about, and manages to find out quite a bit of the detail of what was intended with Project Orion. The big surprise to me, the thing that I just could not get my head around, was that they intended to launch this craft from the surface of the Earth.
That's right. That's right. They,
you know, I mean,
now
I,
they were hoping to be able to develop cleaner bombs.
Yes.
They were. That was the hope.
Required
but
clean bombs.
But you know, this was again, Phil. This was like the 50s and early 60s, and I mean, you know, they thought nothing of blowing things up. You know, and the, you know, blowing up a dozen nuclear bombs out in the deserts in Nevada. Why not just, you know, for something as important as a spaceship to Saturn, you know, setting off a few nukes in some remote place, not a big deal to them back then. It would be impossible to get that done now.
It would, and maybe with good reason, I think.
Yeah.
You know, probably launching all those nukes wasn't...
would not have been necessarily a great idea, but I still think that there's a possibility that the world may see an Orion spaceship launch from the surface of the Earth at some point. You know, what if China decided that they wanted to leapfrog the United States and show off their prowess? And you know, why would they want to go? Why would they want to do the moon the way we did the moon? You know.
Well, I can't imagine wanting to do the moon the way we did, although they've been talking about doing the moon not that different from the way we did it. But
right.
If one were to build an Orion, it seems to me that what one would want would be to build it in orbit.
Yeah.
And then launch it from there. You know, you want to have some kind of Earth to low Earth orbit rocket launching going on to create Orion and then actually launch the nukes out in space. That seems
but, I mean,
like,
if you're going to make a big – you're talking a huge, huge craft. I mean, you would need, who knows, maybe, 100 rocket launches to get the material into orbit to do that in orbit?
Yeah,
you
would have to really have a scalable rocket launch thing going on, which would be practical for a lot of other reasons too, not just for building Orion. It seems like that would – That would be a good way to get.
Couldn't you just see China? They'll give us a call and say, "Oh, by the way, you know, don't get nervous too much when you pick up the nuclear explosion that you're going to pick up in Outer Mongolia. It's not us trying to nuke anybody, or it's not us being nuked. It's us going to Saturn and see ya." I mean,
that would be pretty astounding.
Yeah.
Absolutely would. Although I think maybe that's where the bureaucratic mindset of NASA was helpful. Their idea was, let's use Saturn V's and we'll build the thing in space. Of course, they scaled it way down. They were going to send it to Mars rather than
to Saturn. Yes,
to Jupiter and Saturn.
It'd be a smaller ship. Yeah,
and it would have been smaller. It wouldn't have been as cool. I mean, yeah, the idea of this rocket the size of the Empire State Building launching from, you know, somewhere in the U.S. Southwest with just a series of hydrogen bombs blasting it into space is just a It's a great image, that's for sure. It would have made a great science fiction story if it hadn't been something that they were really trying to make happen.
That's right.
Well, I think that just about does it for this edition of Fast Forward Radio. Tell us about the music we'll be listening to this evening.
Well, the band is called Spirit Creek, and the song is That Lie Inside. And you can get the links to the hi-fi version of this at our website in the show notes. That's thespeculist.com. There are blog.speculus.com to get straight to it, and of course we'll have links to all the other topics that we talked about tonight.
All right, so we'll look forward to being with you all again on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.
Good night.